it's a funny term, isn't it? This unstoppable nostalgia bus. It's just everybody's crawling out of the woodwork and seemingly filling arenas left, right and centre. It's extraordinary.
Well, I mean, it's interesting. One of the things that didn't go in the interview that I did with Mark Morris was I asked him about exactly that. I sort of said, oh, you know, what about a new Blue Tones record? Wouldn't that be good? You know, there seems to be a lot of interest in the whole kind of, you know, mid-90s thing. And he said, well, the thing to remember is that these things either happen for slightly less noble reasons, you know, people maybe want to make a buck. Not that there's anything particularly wrong with that, you know, if people have talent, why shouldn't they make money out of it?
Absolutely not, yeah.
But he also said that there are other bands for whom it's just the right time. And he specifically pointed to Shed 7. He said, you know, there's a band who have been touring and doing bits and pieces for sort of 17 years. They've never had any interest in doing anything new. And then it just happened, and they've had enormous success. So he feels quite comfortable with that.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly don't have a problem with it. You know, like, say good luck. I don't really know the story of Shed 7, whether they actually ever went away or whether they kind of down tools for a period and tried something else. But you know, often with bands, you know, you start, you're very young, and that's what you do, you know, and you do that for a lot of those groups, ourselves included, in way into your sort of 20s, your late 20s. And then, you know, it's sort of what you do, really. So if you can find a way to get back and, you know, to pay your bills by doing the thing that you love, then why not? Good luck to them, I say.
I think I've been to see a couple of these bands now. You know, Echo Belly I saw recently, and I went to see Shed 7. And I have to say that there was an enormous feeling of joy in the room. People really wanted to be there, and people were enjoying it. And it interestingly, it didn't have the air of nostalgia, you know. But interestingly, both of those bands had new records out, and I think that is something a bit different to David Van Day trudging out the latest version of Dollar.
Well, that's true, isn't it? I mean, there is very much that kind of strictly nostalgia tour where, you know, a generation beyond, you know, are just playing a selection of hits and kind of rehashing them. But, you know, when you saw Shed 7, for example, did it seem that a lot of the audience connected or were familiar with the new material? Was there almost like a new fan base in addition to those that loved them first time around?
I think so. I think that is accurate, actually, Harry. I think that there were people there. I don't know. The new record is, I mean, what do I know about these things? But for me, it's better than the things they did that brought them fame and fortune and sex and drugs and rock and roll the first time around. It's a very accomplished set of pop songs, you know? Songs that are kind of slightly joyous and anthemic, and people seem to really enjoy those songs as much as they enjoyed the older material. So, you know, and it was a very similar thing with Echo Belly, who I think were probably much, you know, out of those two bands, they probably had more in common with Elka. They were slightly more artistic, slightly more serious, you know, dealing with slightly grander themes, you know, and were perhaps slightly more outsiderish than Shed 7 were. But I don't know, maybe.
Well, you know, it's music, isn't it? And for my money, it's still the greatest art form. There is just something so utterly visceral and all-consuming about music. And, you know, if you love it, you love listening to it, and actually being there whilst it's happening, surrounded by, you know, numerous other people that are having that moment, there's nothing really like it. I mean, you know, I'm not a big sports fan, but the only kind of parallel I've ever found is being, you know, in the heat of a big football match, you know, where everybody is there completely connected to that moment and experiencing that very physical reaction to what's going on around them. It's a beautiful thing, isn't it?
I think that's exactly right. I think the difference between the sporting analogy and music is the emotional pull that, particularly for, you know, a band like Elka, at the risk of being sycophantic again, that there seemed to be something very honest and very pure about not only the music, but about the voice and the words. And I think when you have that, when there is an honesty, when you genuinely feel like the band who are in front of you, you know, to be very trite about it, mean it, man, that is something that is unparalleled.
Well, you know, it's lovely to hear you say that, but I don't know, what can I say? I mean, for us, from day one, it was always the real deal. You know, we came together when we were very young. We passionately adored music, playing music, making music. And really, there was no, in our journey, there was no sort of cynical attempt really to, you know, be a band and write music in a certain kind of way because we thought that it might appeal or it might, you know, achieve a kind of desired success. You know, of course, we wanted to be successful and we wanted as many people as possible to hear our music. But, you know, there was never really a template for what we did. We just played and played and played and played until we sort of connected and looked at each other and said, that's the sound that we want to make, or that's the sound that feels right. I suppose to that end, it should have felt honest, should have felt real. I certainly hope it did, because it did to us, you know.
Well, I wonder, maybe you could tell me something about those early days then, Harry. I'm interested in, you know, this gang of boys. I'm always interested in things like, you know, those first records or the first songs that you remember hearing or the first gigs that you went to and those kind of first moments where you thought, you know what, I want to do that.
You know, just before we get into this point, I feel I've got to say this to you. It's something of a strange experience for me because this sort of recent flurry of Elka sort of returning to my life, you know, I mean, obviously it was a huge part of my life and all of our lives. But, you know, it was a while ago since we last played, you know, 20-odd years. And, you know, and a lot's gone on in that time. And in my case, you know, not a lot of music, really. When that stopped for me, it stopped, and maybe we'll get on to the whys and the wherefores. So I'm sort of sitting here now really trying to put a cap that I haven't worn for many years on sort of revisit that time. I'm really happy to do it. I'm really flattered that, you know, someone like yourself, you know, wants to talk about it. But it does feel a bit strange. So forgive me you know, I need to warm up a little bit to the groove of things.
Talk to me about first records and early influences, and I'm particularly interested in, you know, what it was that made you feel, you know what, I want to do that.
Well, I suppose another nice thing really about talking about it with the benefit of this hindsight is I feel less of an obligation to sort of, you know, please Melody Maker by dropping all the right kind of references. So I feel incredibly liberated to be very honest about influences and those early days without the need to try and be cool. You know, it was what it was. The story really was, I was at school with the drummer in Elka, Darren, and we both went to a theatre school and we were both training. He was training to be a dancer, actually, and I was to be an actor. And it was great. To cut a long story short, we both had really pretty horrendous times at school. You know, I'd been kicked out of a couple and a similar journey. And to cut a long story short, we both managed to, independent of each other, but to land a place at this school called the Arts Education School. So off we went along there, and that was extraordinary. There were, I think the ratio was something like 8 girls to 1 boy. You know, and we did half a day where we did our academic work, and the rest of the day we pranced around acting or dancing, and it was amazing, really happy days. And but that was the sort of, that kind of professionalism was drummed into us really from about the age of 13, you know, what it means to really rehearse, what it means to really, you know, take what you're doing seriously and the stakes and all the rest of it. So I was very much minded that was going to be my life. I wanted to be an actor, and I was really serious about that. And then at about the age of, I guess, about 14, I kind of came to me. I'd always liked music, but I'd never really been, you know, passionately into bands per se. But I guess the first band that I really fell in love with was U2, actually. A girl that I was seeing at the time had an older brother, gave me a copy of Under a Blood Red Sky. And I just fell in love with it, really. I wasn't sort of clued up to the politic of U2. And at that point, I guess, as well, a lot of the kind of flack that certainly Bono came under didn't exist. You know, they were quite an interesting band who were kind of conquering America in a way that few had done for many years before them. And they had a kind of scale to their sound that just intrigued me and really grabbed me. And literally, really, that summer, I just started to discover bands. And really, my first kind of wave of bands was that almost kind of folky, tinged sort of pseudo stadia rock, I suppose. I mean, other bands like the Waterboys, I was quite taken with. Simple Minds, I think, at the time were doing some quite interesting stuff. Suddenly I thought, you know what, this is amazing. This is kind of acting, but you get to write your own script. Darren at the time, you know, he was playing drums. You know, from day one, he was irritatingly brilliant at music, you know, a real virtuoso, the kind of guy that, you know, I kid you not, you know, he can turn his hand to pretty much any instrument and tinker with it, and within a month or so, he's pretty decent. So he and I set about forming a band. My cousin, Marcus, had played guitar since he was 7 years old, and my other best friend at the time, Rhodey, played fuck all and did fuck all and was at home having been expelled himself from school. And I said, do you want to be in a band? And he said, yeah, that sounds cool. I said, well, learn the bass, because that's, you know, we need someone to play the bass. And that's really how it all started. You know, we were about, as I say, 14, 15. We came together, and interestingly, I think for us, we never, ever did the kind of covers thing. From day one, when we came together, we only ever tried to write, and I emphasize the word tried at that point, you know, our own material. And it was predictably dreadful to begin with, and these sort of long, hopelessly pretentious poems about, oh, God knows what. I think the first song literally was called Ambition that we wrote. But, you know, it kind of clicked, and we really fell for it. And that was a turning point. And from that, literally from that sort of moment of, wow, this is music. And I suppose what it was really was that all of us, to an extent, didn't really have that relatively longer gestation period of being a fan. You know, we'd all sort of came to discovering music and specifically bands. I mean, I should add as well that there was also a shared love, you know, talk about the other side of the coin, at that time of Prince. So yeah. There's sort of one foot in this kind of folky, rocky, you know, kind of overblown stuff. And then there's this other foot in kind of funky Prince and Rare Groove. And we sort of threw that all into the mix and just, you know, just started, really. And we didn't play any gigs or do anything for a good 2 or 3 years. But we practiced obsessively. I mean, any time we could, you know, at least 2 or 3 times a week, your parents, you know, garages or a church hall that was sort of, you know, one of the mums gave us access to, you know, wherever we could, really. Pooled our resources, bought the bare minimum of kit. And that's kind of how it started for the first few years. And then, but then beyond that, obviously, once we started to get into that mindset, we really started to, you know, discover a much broader range of references. And, you know, the Stone Roses and the kind of rise of Manchester was starting to take off. I mean, prior to that, the whole kind of shoegazing scene never really did it for me or for anyone. No disrespect to those bands, but just didn't really feel it. And I remember very much being a bit sort of indifferent to what was then very much the indie scene. You know, there was the indie charts, I don't know, the Wonder stuff, and Pop Will Eat Itself,
yeah,
that whole scene. So you know, but the turning point, and not the second turning point, I suppose, was the Stone Roses and that album. And when that kind of came out, but that upped the ante massively for all of us. And I went to Spike Island and just experienced that kind of cultural moment and just thought, this is unbelievable. And I have to do everything in my power to try and do something like that. I remember seeing Ian Brown walk out on stage holding an inflatable globe.
That's
and
right.
Then just kicking it into the crowd, and the crowd literally surging forward 20 feet, you know, mass tramplings occurring, and just standing there and thinking, this is a moment, this is culture, this is ours, you know. And that galvanized things. And from then it we really, you know, took it quite seriously. A couple of us got a place at university, myself included. I mean, I didn't know, by that point there was nothing else on the horizon. The acting had taken a back seat. I didn't want to get a job. I got to the end of scraping through a few A-levels. That's actually where we met the keyboard player, Matt, at the college that myself and Rody went to. And we just really learned how to smoke dope really, really well for 2 years. And listened a lot to The Cure as well. They'd entered the scene by that point. And particularly the album Disintegration, which actually became very, very important to us in terms of when we came to make Rubbernecking. But I'd blagged a place at a film course at university, and Marcus got somewhere else in London. But the only agenda was, we don't want to get a job. We don't want to break up and kind of move around the country. So what can we do in London that allows us to carry on doing the band? And within a year, we dropped out, signed on. And these were the glorious days, you know, where you could sign on. You could get housing benefit to cover all of your rent. You had to go to the Dole office every 2 weeks and go and they'd say, have you looked for a job? And I'd done photography, so I used to say, yeah. But my real specialism is photographing rare Islamic artifacts, and I just can't find anything in that field. And they just go, okay, fair enough, and tick. And but I look back, you know, that was I feel quite passionately about that, really, because I think people now in that position, you know, in their late teens, that know that they want to do music or art and need that time to develop and need that modicum of support, you know, it's just by all accounts impossible. Whereas for us, we could do that. We could drop out and put all our energy into really upping the ante. And thanks to the government, really.
Of course, this is why increasingly the music scene is dominated by people whose mums and dads have got lots and lots and lots of money. You know, I mean, there's a wonderful moment in the Oasis documentary Supersonic where, you know, they're talking at the end, they've just done Nebworth, the documentary takes you up to that point, and they say exactly that. It's unlikely that you'll ever get, you know, a gang like that from their background ever achieving what they achieved because of exactly what you're talking about. They were able to do it thanks to, you know, the support of the government. It was probably won't happen again.
I watched it again the other night, and I remember exactly that point. It jumped out at me, and I couldn't agree more, you know, and it's a sorry state of affairs, really, because, you know, it was precisely that gave us Oasis and countless other bands, you know, like so much culture today. You know, I mean, acting is another one. It's just utterly, utterly wealth heavy. And I think that's a real negative. And I can't at the moment see how that's going to, you know, be rectified. But fortunately for us, at least, it wasn't the case, and so we could do that.
So you've got to that point. You know you want to be in a band. You've rehearsed. You know you've listened to Hole of the Moon loads and loads of times. And you've
actually, I should also add, we all of us actually took a particularly acid heavy detour during the sort of 17-18. Just before Manchester and rave culture really started to take off. and, you know, just found a whole new raft of very fucking psychedelic, you know, from Hawkwind and Gong and Osric Tentacles, but also the likes of sort of Floyd and Zeppelin and the, you know, Exile era Stones and that quite important canon of kind of quite grandiose songwriting, but nonetheless, you know, amazingly crafted, sculpted.
I would have paid good money, Harry, to have been in a room with you and a Melody Maker journalist in 1997 and for you to have rattled off this list of bands. I would love to have seen that.
You could have paid an awful lot of money and you probably wouldn't have heard it. I don't know, maybe you would. I mean, it's something I've never been ashamed of, but, you know, obviously, you know, there's that kind of hippie, psychedelic kind of era. It's never really been cool, has it? But talking to a lot of other musicians and people that I still know, and some of them quite successful, it's a funny little scene, that one, that seems to have influenced a lot of people. I mean, Noel Gallagher's one of them. He was a real kind of head for that music. But, you know, if you look at a lot of Floyd or Zeppelin, for example, the sort of symphonic approach to songwriting, as opposed to the very catchy kind of 3-minute pop craft, you know, I think it's really important. It was hugely important to how we went about writing songs, and texture and that sense of scale, you know, and pace within a song. And I suppose, really, if I look back on Elka's songwriting, I mean, that was when we would go about writing, you know, it wasn't like we sat down and said, right, let's listen to fucking Dark Side of the Moon and try and, you know, write that. But that, it becomes so sort of part of our subconscious, really, that it was inevitably always going to be there. And then when we finally, and it took us a long time, really, to grasp the fundamentals of classic, you know, verse, bridge, chorus, middle eight, you know, that sort of tighter approach to song. But when that collided with the sort of looser, lusher, you know, stuff from that kind of, you know, late 60s, early 70s sound that we were hearing, I think it really clicked for us. And that's when, you know, I feel that we kind of discovered what we could sound like, really.
And of course, what you could sound like ultimately, you know, was thrust into the spotlight with Rubbernecking, which, you know, to my mind is, you know, probably the great lost album of that particular era. You know, there were lots of albums that sold lots more copies and there were lots of bands who got lots more column inches, but the truth of the matter is that it's an incredible collection of songs with an incredibly individual and very unique sound to it. And I wonder if you can think back to, you know, you've finished recording, it's ready to go, you've got this little curate's egg, you're about to thrust it out into the spotlight. If you were aware of how good it was, and if you had any expectations for it.
Just, it's really, really gratifying to hear you say that. I'm really grateful. Because we had massive hopes for it. And I think all of us were, we were really proud of that record. I mean, if I went back now, there's certainly changes and tweaks that I make, but broadly speaking, certainly in terms of a collection of songs, lyrically and musically, I'm really proud of the work that we did on the album. You know, I mean, this is where The Cure sort of returned. I still, to this day, think that Disintegration is one of the greatest albums ever recorded. It's just a phenomenal piece of work, the songwriting, but also the production, the way that it sounds. And I always remember sort of, you know, sitting there looking at that LP, you know, obviously it was a record, in my house anyway, and reading, this album was recorded to be played loud, so turn it up.
That's right.
And it really, really was, and the production on it was just extraordinary. And so, you know, when we landed our deal and we started to shop around for producers, Island Records were very keen to introduce us to all sorts of, you know, flavours of the month, really. And
we had all sorts of meetings with, many names escaped me really, but, you know, names of the day, and they'd just done Echo Belly, or they'd just done whoever, you know, and we were just really clear by that point about who we wanted to work with and the kind of record that we wanted to make in terms of that scale. And that's why we tracked Dave Allen down, who produced Disintegration, and we met with Dave, and we did a couple of sessions with him, and we were immediately, there was no question in our minds that that's who we wanted to work with. I think he brought a huge amount to that record. The songs were all there, actually, and when we went in, I should backtrack a little bit, because when in the kind of, you know, dropping out and you know, government-sponsored development period, you know, we were fucking rigorous about it. We took ourselves and what we were doing very seriously. And I don't mean we took ourselves seriously in the sense that we thought that everything that we uttered was utterly profound and, you know, we were there to save the world. You know, we were never really a kind of a band with a message, if you like, and then politics was pretty low on our agenda, but we were committed to the idea, I think, of making songs that just really, really set your arse on fire when you were listening to them, and playing songs live and the whole kind of live experience for us was, you know, equally, if not more, I think, important than how they sounded on the record. And so meeting, we'd done a lot of our own demos. We built this very modest little studio in some warehouse in the arse end of near Woolwich, actually, just miles from anywhere. And we'd get up every morning, literally at 8 o'clock in the morning, every day, for Sunday. And we'd go there and we would rehearse and record all day, every day, and fucking loved it, you know. So we had the songs and we were pretty clear what we wanted in the album, but it was a question really of finding a way of getting them down that at least tried to approach the sort of the scale that we were sort of beginning to achieve as a live band. I think I digressed. What was the question?
No. No. Yeah, you've answered it. It was about, you know, whether, you know, you were aware of, you know, how good a collection of songs Rubbernecking was and what your expectations were. But it's obvious from that your expectations were that people would listen to it loud and that people would get that same feeling as if they were seeing you live.
It's funny, another turning point on that record actually was when one of the last songs we wrote was Boho Bird, which didn't actually feature on the final release. It came in a sort of second pressing, I believe.
That's right.
We wrote that song, and that was, it's funny actually looking back, because I suppose that was the one time that we got somewhat sucked into the scene, because by that point, we'd gone through kind of new mod, and when we were, you'll remember, you know, how quickly and how desperate the music press then were to kind of create scenes and lump people in.
That's right.
There's a lot of cynicism about that from some quarters. You know, I feel less cynical about it, really. I think there was a lot of good to that, really, because it continually revitalized and, you know, made the whole business of the world of bands exciting, you know, that almost every 15 minutes there was a new scene and everyone was, you know, was getting hyped up about this. The difficulty was from our side of the fence was sort of trying to retain a kind of identity and try to play that game but not get completely swamped by it. And Boho Bird, I think, was the nearest we skirted really towards what was rapidly becoming Britpop and that very sort of modern life is rubbish,
yeah,
suede influenced Englishness, really, in songwriting. I mean, I loved Suede's first album, hearing that, and that was a game changer, and thinking, you know, the shit's just got serious, really. You know, the whole wave of Americana had been kind of going on for a while. I pretty much loathed all of it.
Yeah.
You know, I have to admit, at the time, I didn't get Nirvana at
no,
all.
No, I'm right there with you, Harry.
Were you? Yeah.
Yeah,
I really loved it, but I was just like, meh. You know?
No, I've got no interest in people who are that badly dressed.
Well, this is the other thing. I mean, I'm delighted to hear you say that, because the kind of the idea of, you know, stepping off the stage and being just like the people that are looking at you as being a good thing was utterly, it was anathema to me.
Well, I was brought up in a home where mum and dad were both original mods, you know, 1960s mods. My mum had actually lived in London for a bit and worked in Biba, you know, and so clothes and particularly black soul music, Stax, Atlantic, Motown, all that was,
right.
You know, very, very important. And I mean, you know, I was going to school in kind of mod clobber before the new mod thing started. And I think, that, again, it's possibly a class thing. You know, when you don't have very much, it's really important that you take a bit of pride in your appearance. And when that whole Nirvana grunge thing started, I just remember thinking, this is shameful. This is a celebration of the lowest possible aspirations.
Yeah, I was right there with you, you know, and a power to you. I'm sure we'd have got on famously if we'd have met, because I was very much in that stride. You know, Bowie, by this point, was featuring very much in my consciousness. You know, it's I wanted and loved the kind of, you know, the pop stars that I admired to be, you know, very, very, very different to anyone I'd seen. And that was equally important to me about the whole machine, the whole purpose of a band. It was the idea of complete escape and complete beauty, really, and you know, making yourself into something extraordinary, even if you didn't, and most of us didn't, certainly at that time, you know, have the finances to do it. And it was funny, that new mod thing, because we kind of got into that very besuited look, as far as it felt to us anyway, entirely under our own steam. You know, there was no conscious decision to say, oh, look, this is happening and people are dressing this way, so let's do that. It was literally a very concerted desire to create a kind of look and to feel, you know, feel the money. And so we'd go to charity shops and buy the suits and go and get them tailored, and, you know, and just suddenly this kind of look started to emerge, and it was right, and it fitted with us. And then, you know, extraordinary sometimes how this sort of synchronicity occurs. Literally, it felt like overnight this sort of menswear appeared, and you know, then suddenly every other band, you know, was dressing like that. And that was kind of when we sort of changed the dial, much to the journalist Simon Price's dismay, actually. Oh. I think he rather turned his back on us for that tweet. But yeah, so that kind of, I was talking about Boho Bud, and that was a slight departure, and that was, if you like, dipping a toe into that scene. And a lot of people loved that record. It's not my favourite, to be perfectly honest with you, and I don't think it's the most typical of that collection of songs. But it served us well, because it got, you know, at the time, quite a lot of press, and that was the kind of turning point, really, that you know, suddenly the record labels, we put Boho Bud out on our own label, and you know, suddenly we had sort of, you know, A&R men turning up at the gigs, and
yeah,
it moved very quickly from there.
So what about, I mean, we've kind of talked about it a little bit already, but what about the B word? What about the Britpop thing? Did you, other than Boho Bud, I mean, did you feel part of that scene? Were you aware that there was a scene? Were there other bands that you did like, or that you were, you know, friendly with? Or
yeah, I'm very much aware of a scene. But I think, you know, often in these sort of cultural movements, when you're very much in the middle of something like that, you know, you don't have any hindsight. It's just happening before your very eyes. So I personally never really felt that Elka were a Britpop band.
No.
I didn't really identify with that scene, only insofar as that we were British, and suddenly there was a lot of interesting music coming out of Britain, and there was a lot of kind of attitude and identity. But, you know, really, I mean, if you look back at kind of a lot of the kind of the heavyweights, I mean, Oasis couldn't be more different to Pulp, really, and similarly to Blur. I mean, maybe there's more similarity to Pulp and Blur, but just to take those three as examples, you know, it's a pretty diverse range of music. that was all conveniently lumped together as Britpop. I felt very other to that, but never sort of dismissively so. I didn't. It used to irritate me when I'd read certain bands, you know, that really made it, went out of their way. Oh, so we don't belong to this, we're so other. I rather felt that it was sort of happening for us anyway, although we were sort of happening in that time and sometimes talked about in that context. It always felt to me that Elka were viewed as quite singular, really, and not particularly absolutely slavishly as part of that. A tour, a Melody Maker tour called the Maker Shaker tour.
Where I saw you again, yeah.
Oh, did you see that tour?
I did.
So we had, who was on the bill there? It was
Powder, Pusher Man, and Strangelove.
That's it, right. And, you know, again, a sort of a really kind of eclectic mix, really.
Very much so.
But, you know, Powder, for example, you know, God love them, but you know, there to me was a band that were a very typical example of doing everything in their power to sort of belong to a scene and making sure they were drinking in the right pubs in Camden and, you know, tweaking their outfits and their sound, of course.
Absolutely, yeah.
Whereas Strangelove, I think, were, you know, shared a lot more DNA with Elka insofar as they very much did their thing and there wasn't really a great deal that was going to
Well, I think that the very idea that anybody could put Patrick into any particular box is
when we played with him at the time, he was so deeply in the jaws of alcoholism, it was kind of it wasn't funny.
No.
But you know, again, you know, when looking back to that time, you know, everybody was kind of hitting it so hard that you could kind of hide in plain sight, but he, by all accounts, went through quite a personal odyssey, really. And you know, I haven't really studied his music today too much to give you a fair opinion. But certainly what struck me is that he seems to have retained a kind of integrity and a kind of honesty to what he does that I think is pretty fucking admirable.
Oh, I think so. I think, you know, there are a few people who dance across the glistening waters of pop who genuinely are, you know, artists, you know, people who have a as you say, an integrity, you know.
Yeah.
You know, you've got people like Morrissey at the top end of it. You know, he's probably the best example. Dylan, I guess, you know, is another one. Kevin, yeah. Rowland. And then there are people, and I genuinely, I'm not trying to be sycophantic, Harry, I promise you, but there are people like you and Patrick Duff, you know, who really are trying to be honest and pure and write songs that, you know, have some kind of emotional depth or some kind of connection or will make people feel something, you know, and that is a very admirable quality.
Well, you know, thank you for saying that. And I mean, I suppose the only response that I can give is, you know, I can say absolutely that, and this really connects to us talking about the scene and the whole Britpop bubble, really, is that it wasn't even kind of willful on my part. It was, there was simply, you know, writing songs was massively cathartic and important and deep, you know, for me, you know, and it was inconceivable really to sort of, to do it in the reverse and sit down and say, okay, well, we need to make something sound like X, so this is what we need to do to be successful. It always, perhaps with the slight exception of Boho Bub, which, as I said, was an experiment, if you like. but it just came from the process of doing it and, yeah, trying to write something that connected and that elicited a response in the listener and meant something, you know. And if it didn't mean something to me or to us, then it was quickly discarded. I think we always had quite a good bullshit monitor, really. And we just knew when it was working and we knew when it was right, which kind of, when we get to the kind of end stages of Elka, was probably the main reason why we weren't one of those bands that carried on and looked for the next deal. And there was a chemistry and a kind of alchemy of the five of us playing together that certainly for me was, you know, it was
fraternal and utterly important to the to what we were doing. And I always used to say, I remember saying in one interview that if one of us went, that was the end of the band. And I didn't realise how prophetic that would prove to be, but yeah, that was the case.
Well, so I wonder then if we can maybe get to that. So, you know, Rubbernecking comes out, and you know, there it is for the discerning people who, you know, made the effort to buy it. And then my understanding is that there's a second album, which of course we can now hear kind of in its demo form online, Softly Softly. And but a change in kind of ownership, direction at the record label. They put the blockers on Elka taking the album with them to, you know, take it somewhere else, just in case they may at some point in the future have wanted to release it. And that pretty much spells the end for Elka. I mean, is that accurate?
Yeah, more or less. Rubbernecking came out. Ireland were very, very keen that we released, you know, very quickly. There had been the kind of heat of our own self-releases, Boho, and they just desperately wanted to rush a single out, and they wanted us to do the track Supercharged. And they really pushed hard for us to go and work with a guy called Dave Bascom, a producer who, for my money, is an excellent producer. You know, nothing particularly against him, but the long and short of it was that the mix that he delivered and the mix that Ireland really wanted to rush out, it just wasn't right for us. We weren't feeling it. And Marcus, the guitarist, and Marcus and I were really kind of the main songwriters for most of the work, actually. And he just wasn't happy with it. And we were very stubborn and just said, you know, if we're not all behind it as a record, then we can't live with ourselves of just releasing it. I mean, you know, we were naive as well. I'm fully open to that now, you know, as I'm older and I understand how these things work more. But actually, I don't really regret that. There was a sort of, it was kind of part of the integrity of who we were as a band. And we hadn't spent as long as we had making that record, only to be sort of coerced into releasing what we thought was a bit of a bastardization of one of the tracks. So we said, no, we don't want to release that. We're not going to release that. And we took a while to get that next release right, which turned out to be Look At You Now. But I think some of the momentum had been lost. I think critically, I'm not guarded at all in my disdain for Island Records and how I think that they treated Elka. They treated us abysmally. And I think there was a real sense of fuck you to some extent from our A&R man and from the label, in that, you know, well, if you're not going to play ball by our terms, then we're not going to, you know, pay back. And they didn't really push that single very hard. And it started to get a little bit wobbly even at that point. However, galloping to our rescue at the time was Mr. Morrissey, who just out of the blue, we got a call and he said, Morrissey loves your album and he wants you to support him on his next world tour. To which we said, fucking... how can we possibly refuse?
Of course.
I mean, you know, there's a moment like that in life don't come along. We were all massive Smiths fans. I adored Morrissey. I still do. Most of the time. you know, that was extraordinary. And again, Ireland sort of ummed and ahed about it and a bit costly and tour support and all the rest of it. And, you know, but I particularly just refused really to take no for an answer. And there was a lot of kind of, you know, doorstepping Ireland and saying, you know, this just has to happen. And so, you know, we went off on that tour and it was a hugely important period of our relatively brief career in the spotlight, because for the first time, really, I mean, by that point, we probably got to a point where, well, we headlined the Garage, I think, for two nights, and that was about, I think it was a 2,000 capacity, the Garage up in Highbury and Islington. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Still there, actually.
It is still there, that's right.
So, you know, we'd certainly started to build a half-decent fan base, and they were incredible gigs, and, you know, that
elusive tipping point was beginning to sort of reveal itself. But then he, you know, invites us to that to support him as the only band actually on
pretty much
the whole tour. So we were playing to 30,000 people, you know, on many nights. We played Central Park. We played the LA Greek. We played some extraordinary venues, and you know, of course, the vast majority were there to see Morrissey, and you know, hardly anyone at the start of the tour knew who the fuck we were. But it was fascinating to, as it unfolded, to sort of literally to see this Elka fan base begin to swell, and you know, by the literally coast to coast, we started on the East Coast, and whatever it was, 5 or 6 weeks later, we ended up in Los Angeles playing the Greek. And there was a sense, you know, of all of us, where we just said, fucking hell, you know, this is, something's happened here. You know, this has been important for us, because there was a visible contingent that had got there early. And as well as the Morrissey banners, there was a really good smattering of Elka banners, you know. So that was extraordinary in that, you know, we playing those kind of crowds, realizing that we could do that and that we could, you know, I mean, we were very well aware setting off on that tour that it was not, you know, historically the easiest gig supporting Morrissey.
No.
You know, audiences tended to be pretty dismissive of, you know, of anybody that just sort of wasted their time before he came on stage. And, you know, it would be an exaggeration to say that everybody was swooning to our we seemed to, and he told me on more than one occasion, buck that trend to a great extent, and you know, kind of win a lot of that audience over. And as well as that, and as well as playing those kind of bigger audiences, which really felt right in terms of the sort of scale of what we were trying to do in the sound, we began to write the second album. So when we finally came back, we did America with him, we did a lot of Europe and Scandinavia, and we came back and we had, I would say, a good chunk of the second album written or ready to demo. And we had a 2-album firm deal with Island Records. And that had been a massive swayer for us, really, in terms of who we signed. Because we, you know, at the time of the deal, we had 3 or 4 offers, different labels. And this two firm, this elusive two firm, as it was known, was the kicker for us.
Yeah.
They guaranteed to record and to release 2 albums. And then you know, the option could be tabled again. So we did go straight back into the studio, and we started to record what was to become Softly Softly. And you know, I was really proud of that album. I have to say, to be perfectly honest with you, I'm prouder of that album in terms of the songs than I think I am of Rubberneck. I mean, it's sort of Favorite Child, isn't it? But I was aware of how much we had progressed in the direction that I believe that we could and were going in. And it was an important album to me, and what at the time I thought would be, you know, just our second album, you know, en route to fully flowering by about the fourth. But that's when the kind of real horror show started to kick in, and we'd agreed to release the single Pleasure as the first single from that album, and it really started to do well. It was getting a lot of attention from the radio stations, B-listed. Oh Christ, I sound like Lisa from Steps. Was that notorious? But we were B-listed at Capital. But we were at Radio 1, which was, you know, that was the first time really that the sort of national radio sort of picked up on a tune of ours, and it was all looking really, really good, and I was in a studio with Marcus. We were just rehearsing to do a short promo tour, just the two of us, around regional stations to promote the album and the single, you know, just the acoustic version of it. And I got to the studio in Holloway, and he hadn't turned up. And, you know, we're still in the just before the arrival of mobile phones. So I found a payphone in a pub and phoned him up. I said, "Where the fuck are you?" You know, blah blah blah. You know, ranting, as was my particular bent when it came to any professional indiscretion. And he said, "You better come home. We've been dropped." There was a lot of politics at play and all the rest of it, but somehow, which, to be honest with you, Paul, I've never truly got to the bottom of. I think there was certainly some foul play from our management to an extent. There were some other interests involved. But really, I think the main crux of it was that Ireland were able to hide behind the sales in Universal and kind of say, you know, it's not me, Gov. You know, the bean counters from the Big Daddy label have come in and, you know, you're a casualty and so are a lot of others. And so that was it, really, right at the point where it felt that we absolutely, you know, got ourselves into the best shape ever as a live band. We'd have this new clutch of songs which we were all really, really enthused by. And it seemed that we had the kind of right press attention for it all to go. And then it sort of came to an abrupt halt.
I mean, this maybe sounds like a very silly question, but I'm trying to think, well, what do you do then? You know, this thing that you've devoted all of this time to, all of this energy, thousands of miles on the road, you know, craft and care and love and attention, and now all of a sudden it's over with a capital O. What do you do?
Well, you fall apart to begin with, for sure, and there was a bit of that all around, really. Darren decided, I have to be a little bit careful here because I don't want to be, you know, break up too much.
Of course.
Too much shit. But he was seduced into the idea that he could be a solo artist and announced to us shortly after Ireland dropped us, and our immediate response was, fuck them. We'll get the album back somehow and we'll sign another deal. And we started immediately talking to a couple of other labels and management. And then Darren sort of turned around and said, actually, I think I want to do something on my own. And that just, it just felt like a sort of killer blow, really, because, and I said to you earlier that quote I once gave, which is, if one of us left,
yeah,
then it wouldn't be the band anymore. It just sort of rang in my head. And I just felt at that point that, you know, that we would be limping along literally without one limb. And we talked a lot about it, and there was a lot of kind of discussion, and there was a lot of resistance. But I have to say that it took me a long time to be able to say this, but I have to take responsibility really for probably pulling the trigger on that. And that I just thought, I don't see a way that we can be the band that I believe that we are if he or any one of us left. And I mean, I'm not exaggerating. It's taken a lot of growth and a lot of the passing of time to sort of revisit that period and actually view it in a somewhat different way. Because I think there was a real appetite from all of us, and certainly from the rest of the band, to continue. And, you know, who knows how it would have panned out. It could have been a very familiar story of kind of, you know, limping sadly towards, you know, decreasing circles. But of course, it could have also been quite different. But at that time, there'd been a lot of that kind of shit. And those two major events, I just felt completely ruined by it and really should have probably just taken a bit of time out and regrouped. I didn't. And I moved into something else entirely different very quickly. And sort of buried it for quite a while, actually.
Well, I wonder then, you know, we've talked about this a couple of times already, about the fact that there is clearly an interest, not only more generally in that period in British popular culture, and I don't know if it's got to do with the, you know, we're coming up to the, well, it is now the anniversary of 1998, is the kind of, you know, 20th anniversary of kind of peak Britpop, blah, blah, blah. But more specifically, Harry, and you know, you've been very humble about things. But there is clearly, you know, a bit of an appetite for Elka specifically. That, you know, people, you know, there is a little bit of chatter here and there online.
You know, you'll know that Marcus, the guitarist, has sort of started to pull some stuff together, and basically the idea came about that, you know, all of us kind of moved into different parts of, you know, life and new chapters and all the rest of it. But we all stayed, you know, the one blessing, I think, really, from that kind of horrible fallout and demise was that we survived, our relationships somehow managed to survive, and that we didn't sort of all sort of start hating each other and not talking for years. We all remained very close, and it was almost as if we'd all experienced something of a kind of catastrophe together, and we sort of, it perversely bound us in some ways. You know, a while ago, about a year ago, Marcus suggested pulling some kind of definitive archive together online. And it felt like a good idea because, you know, enough of us, you know, you tell people you're in a band and what band, oh, and they can listen to it. Fucking hell, actually, you were quite good, all of that kind of
that's
shit.
That's right.
And so we thought, you know, good, let's just have a kind of, you know, a tombstone, if you like. And but it does definitely seem to have sort of kind of, you know, lit a couple of matches here and there. But, you know, I'm a bit sanguine about it, really. I put it this way. The story I've just told you and that ending point, it really was, I can only speak for myself in this context, but it really was, you know, just a very, very difficult time and a very difficult event. And the only way I could get through it, really, and past it, was by essentially putting it into a box and labelling that my past and creating a new future. And I moved into television, and that's what I currently still do. I did some writing for a while, but I've worked certainly for the last sort of 15 years, really, developing and or making television at one stripe or the other. And I never sang again. I never got involved with another band again. And people would say to me, "What do you mean you never sing? Like, you know, what don't you? Yeah. Don't you fancy?" And I was. It was just perfectly obvious to me that no, it was, you know, I did that in that context with those people. It was a thing. It wasn't just singing, you know, it wasn't just playing guitar because I love playing guitar. It was making music with Elka. That was what I did, and that's what I loved doing, and that's what was important. And so really to do anything else for me was inconceivable, and it would somehow cheapen really what Elka meant to me. But it's literally only, I would say, in the last year or two that somehow a bit of a fire has returned. And we've started talking to each other, and there's a sort of desire, if for no other reason, than to perhaps find a way of getting back together to play, literally, perhaps just for ourselves, but to hear those songs again, and crucially, to play them again. And so, talking to yourself, and there's, you know, there's been a clutch of other interviews that have just materialized, and somebody from New York is quite eager to release the second album, but, you know, not as demos as it was intended,
yeah.
Or, you know, to remix it. So I genuinely don't really know what to say at this point, but I think all of us are very, very mindful not to be seduced by, you know, a beautiful dream, and are quite sort of realistic about the realities of what that might involve and the kind of hubris, really, of reforming in any kind of overblown way and, you know, trying to put a tour together. Because I just would have no idea, really, what kind of interest there would be and whether we'd struggle to fill the Dublin Castle or whether there could be, you know, a string of carefully thought about dates that would enable us to sort of, you know, play a few shows to people that cared about it. So that's really where we're at, I think, is very carefully thinking about whether that could be a possibility.
I genuinely can't thank you enough for finding a bit of time. I know exactly how difficult it is when you've got a family to find any time for anything for yourself. So I'm really, really grateful.
Watch this space, because I'd love to see if there might be, in some way, shape or form, a way that we can play those songs again in some context.